This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen has long since looked beyond the numbers of development and growth and into the affairs of the human heart. What he sees there these days he finds dismaying. From east to west, he warns, people around the world are being boxed into narrow, dangerous understandings of their own identity, reduced from full and complex human beings to simply Muslim, Christian, Shiite, Sunni, Hindu, Jew. Sen has a bone to pick with Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations thesis. It is the road to hell, he says. We're on it, but we don't have to be. Up next on Point, Nobelist Amartya Sen on identity, violence, and what he calls the illusion of destiny. First, this hour, we begin in Washington with the latest on the high-volume immigration debate on Capitol Hill. Joining me now is Maura Reynolds, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Maura, thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
So here we are. We've been hearing immigration fireworks going off all week long. Where does this stand as we reach the end of the week?
Well, there was a fairly big development last night, which is that the Republicans have come up with a compromise that, at least as of last night, they said had a support of the majority of the Republican caucus. This allows them to proceed with their ideas on immigration, which would divide illegal immigrants who want to apply for citizenship into a three-tiered system. This is a variation on the McCain-Kennedy proposal that's been out since last week.
How did they get to what looks like a compromise here? They seemed so stuck earlier. What happened?
Well, there's sort of a symbolic point, and that is whether illegal immigrants in the United States should have to leave the country, even if only for a short period of time, and re-enter legally in order to apply for citizenship. This is a sticking point for many conservative Republicans who think that that's a very important act of symbolism. And what they came up with is a plan last night that would allow people who've been in the United States for 5 years or more to bypass that step. But more recent arrivals, people who've been here between 2 and 5 years, as part of the process, at some point, they would have to leave the United States to a port of entry and then re-enter on a legal visa.
Do you have a sense of what some of the most prominent players are saying about what's being hammered out here? McCain, Ted Kennedy, Bill Frist, where do they stand?
Well, at this point, it looks like people who've been pushing for this bill, whether they are Democrats or Republicans, are willing to get behind this plan. It might not have been everything that all of them wanted, but it seems to be enough to get 60 senatorial votes, which is the hurdle. Senator Kennedy came out this morning and said that he would get behind Hegel Martinez, and that's seen as a very significant development that gives many Democrats cover to vote for this, even though it's not as inclusive a measure as they would have liked.
So, Maura, if you could, just outline for us, because it seems to be changed so much and so many pieces up in the air, what's likely to be passed here will look like what in terms of who can come, who can stay, guest workers?
Well, this is all changing, you know, minute by minute and hour by hour, Tom, so I can't promise you that I know what's going to happen
okay.
At this point. But if the Hegel-Martinez measure goes forward, and we will know that tomorrow because there'll be a vote on it at least tomorrow and perhaps later today, what it would look like is that anybody who has entered the United States illegally after 2004 would get no benefits. If they wanted to legalize themselves, they would have to return to their home countries, and they would have to apply through normal channels. People who had been here between 2 and 5 years could apply for temporary visas through either one of the existing visa programs or a new visa category that would be created by this legislation. But like I said, they would have to at least make a toe touch outside of the United States in order to get that visa. And then people who'd been here 5 years or more would be allowed to apply for visas and then for permanent residency and citizenship on the 11-year process that was laid out under the McCain-Kennedy proposal. So the distinction is really for people who've been here less than 5 years, and people who've been here 5 years or more would basically go through the procedure that's been talked about for the last couple of weeks.
A lot of work to get to this point, but then it has to meet up with the House version, much, much tougher. So is all this just going to be thrown into the air again?
Well, that's, you know, perfectly possible. The House version is much more restrictive and much more punitive. It is the measure that would make it a felony to be in the United States without a legal visa. Right now, I mean, that measure was passed at a time when people weren't really paying that much attention to the immigration reform debate. The public sentiment, and more importantly, perhaps, the mood in the Republican Party seems to have shifted at least a bit towards a less punitive approach. So at this point, the momentum seems to be behind Hagel-Martinez. That may give senators a little more leverage when they have to negotiate with the House side. But, you know, Tom, this is all up in the air. We'll just have to see how it goes.
Maura, thanks very much for bringing us up to date. We'll be watching. Thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Maura Reynolds, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with us from Washington. Joining me now from San Francisco is Amartya Sen. He won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1998. He's former master of Trinity College at Cambridge in England. He's currently a professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard and is widely considered one of the world's leading public intellectuals. He's author of many books, most recent, the newest, Identity and Violence, The Illusion of Destiny. Amartya Sen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Give us your core argument. What's going on?
Well, in the book, I try to argue that the problem of seeing human beings in terms of just one identity is to miniaturize human beings, which is a pretty bad description of people because we have so many different groups that we belong to. The same person could be an American citizen of Malaysian origin, Chinese ancestry, a Christian, a woman, a vegetarian, hundreds of other things. And to eliminate all that and to just concentrate on one, as if that's the only natural description, is to reduce human beings. So that's the first problem. Mm. But the result of that, of course, is to the world in which we live, which is divided in diverse ways, is much less confrontational than just picking up one division, which is done in a thing like a Clash of Civilizations, and approaches like that. And that generates an artificial tension of being divided along one hardened, predefined line of partition. And I think that's really done a lot of harm, unfortunately, I think.
You're very critical of the perspective of Samuel Huntington, who wrote about the Clash of Civilizations. Of course, he wasn't welcoming it. He was saying, surprisingly, at this point in our history, here's where we are, post-Cold War, cultural distinctions turning into conflict. Not the world as he wishes it would be, but as
he sees it. My difference with Sam, whose intellect I greatly respect, he has done really great work, is not because I think for a second that he's recommending it. It's the way he sees the world. The way he sees the world is people defined by a singular identity confronting each other. He would like to avoid it, yeah. But and my belief is that the duality, the conflict that he sees is to some extent generated by his conceptual categories. And people don't see themselves like that, partly because the civilizations have all had great interactions with each other, and that the history of science and mathematics and literature and music and painting and everything else brings that out. But partly also that we have so many different identities that we have. There's nothing special about the fact that the same person could be a woman with a strong sense of feminist identity, could be a Christian with a strong sense of Christian identity, maybe a doctor with a strong identity, as well as coming from Egypt and having a strong identity of that kind. So to drown it all in just one is, I think it's really the vision that I'm criticizing. But I also say, aside from clarifying that I don't for a second think that Sam is recommending a clash. I'm concerned with the diagnosis. But the other point is that I'm also very critical of those who don't see a clash, but who would like to divide the world into exactly the same classification. But then instead of taking the turn that Sam Huntington does, saying, oh, yes, they're bound to clash, to say, no, they need not. What we ought to have is to have dialogue between civilizations. Now, people interact with each other in hundreds of in ways, in their profession, in their, in you know, through the media, in politics, hundreds of ways they do, and to generate the kind of path to peace through dialogue between civilization is to first reduce human beings into one dimension, and then pursue peace in that very narrow avenue that's left after the miniaturization has occurred. So I'm just as critical of those who want friendliness among civilizations but define human beings in terms of just one identity as I am of those like Sam who divide human beings in the same way and see a clash. Mm.
So you say whether people come at it from a positive perspective or a negative perspective, if you look at it as categories of civilization and everybody boxed into one, losing track of multifaceted identity, Amartya Sen, you make the link between tightly wound, narrow identities and violence. I wish you'd describe that dynamic for us.
Well, I think, first of all, to recognize that the multiple identities that we have standardly as a feature of leading a life, namely we belong to many different groups, are invariably reduced into one when people actually cultivate violence. I remember as a child when suddenly the Hindu-Muslim riots erupted in the 1940s in the pre-partition India. People who had seen themselves in unified terms, you know, and they were also Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs, among other many other things, other than being vegetarian, non-vegetarian, left of politics, right of politics. But suddenly all that was dropped. And, you know, in the hands of the instigators of violence, people were suddenly beginning to see themselves as a fierce Muslim or a fierce Hindu who had to undo the historical wrong that have been done to either of the communities. And that's the way it's generated. That's the way the Hutu identity against Tutsis are generated.
In Rwanda.
In Rwanda, and making people suddenly say, well, you are not a Hutu, you are not a Rwandan and an African or a human being, you're a Hutu, we hate Tutsis. That's how it's generated. Now, so I think that is the royal route to violence. Now, the response to that, of course, is that, of course, I'm a Hutu, but, you know, I'm also Rwandan and African and a human being. And that really also indicates that we have a freedom to define ourselves in a different way from the way the instigators wants us to see ourselves. Now, when we have an analysis of the currents in the world in terms of this extraordinarily narrow categories, overlooking the way the world interacts with each other and how many things come into play, I think we reduce it. I mean, just to give an example, I mean, one of the great figures in my country, for example, is Mahatma Gandhi. Mm-hmm. Now, he is an Indian. He had his legal education in London. He cut his political teeth, for which the Indian politics has every reason to be grateful to Africa. He cut it in South Africa. Mm-hmm. That's where he really came to understanding of the nature of politics, as he explained. He comes back, he practices in India, has an influence, and then eventually influences Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela far away from his country. I mean, you can't capture it in terms of a civilizational categorization at all. I think that is the way civilization is always proceeded, whether in politics, whether in science, mathematics. When a mathematician at MIT or Harvard sits down to do an algorithm, he may or may not recognize that he is unconsciously commemorating the name of an Arab Muslim mathematician from 9th century, Al-Khwarizmi, from whose name the term algorithm is derived, and from whose book Al-Jabr Muqabila the term algebra is derived. Now, here is a 9th century, pretty early, algebraist and mathematician generally, whose work is very central to what is now called Western science and Western mathematics. That's the way the world has proceeded. And, you know, in case of Al-Khwarizmi, you could easily say, here is a Muslim speaking. But the right way of thinking of it is, here is an algebraist speaking. Here is a mathematician speaking. And I think it's these diverse identities which has led to interrelation between people who live in you know, regionally separated, but in communication with each other. And that avenue is still open until we block it out and then concentrate on having some kind of artificially organized dialogue between civilization, as if human beings have to follow that extraordinarily narrow route.
Amartya, let me ask you, if I may. Yeah, if I may. I mean, you're the Nobel Prize winner. I'm not.
But you say that's the way
the world has proceeded. That is, in relations, complex, subtle, nuanced relations between individuals not boxed into narrow identities. And yet your own childhood in India, with the partition of India and Pakistan, scarred by a very different way the world proceeded there. I mean, in many centuries, in many times, we see people battling exactly over these kind of identities and identification with a particular culture. The pushback to your book, Identity and Violence, here has been, this is rose-colored glasses. This is not what's really going on. That the world, in fact, proceeds very much in conflict between civilizations and always has. What do you say to that?
I say to that is the way violence is always instigated. You know, if people suddenly seize themselves as seeing in terms of people living in the same country as people did in India at that time, though they might have had very different politics, including the politics of some people wanting a partition and so on. But there was no reason at all to jump into a situation where just because somebody belonged to a different religion, you have a reason to kill him. Now, that's how the instigation proceeds. Now, the way to deal with it is to recognize how they have reduced human beings before they have got on to advocate and indeed succeed in advocating this kind of violence. Now, the way to interact with it is not to say, okay, that division is exactly right, but Hinduism is not like that, Islam is not like that, which is the way it's proceeding.
You're saying currently leaders, when they say, when President Bush says Islam is a peaceful religion and this is a misunderstanding of it, you're saying that's wrong. Why?
The reason why it's wrong is there are three reasons why it's wrong. One is that it's quite clear why terrorists have every reason to wipe out all identities other than Islamic terrorists will have other than the Islamic identity. But Muslims have never had only an Islamic identity. That may be very important when it comes to religion. But on the other hand, they also have identity as creators of civilization, creators of poetry, creator of mathematics and science, creators of irrigation system in Spain and Europe. They had a lot of other identity. A Muslim, the varieties of and the rich variety of understanding of Muslims is not the same thing as an Islamic identity.
Is it just
terrorists want them to forget it?
Is it just terrorists who want to simplify?
What I'm saying. Mm-hmm. That it's natural for the terrorists to do it. It's completely unnatural for those who are trying to fight terrorism to fall into the same categorization and then say, okay, these people are just Islamic. We forget their algebraic past and their literary past and their artistic past. Mm. We concentrate only on that. Redefine Islam now. It's a religion of peace. Now, the fact of the matter is that that also does some tension with history, because there are a lot of Muslims who have been extraordinarily peaceful and been leaders of peace, but there are also a lot of Muslims who had not been like that, who had waged war. Because Islam in itself doesn't take a position on this. And that's why when there was a meeting of Muslim scholars last summer, arranged in Jordan, in Amman, and when there was an attempt to say that anyone who does terrorist could be described as apostate, the Muslim scholars refused to accept it on ground that the Islamic religious position doesn't take a particular view on that issue. As long as you have the basic beliefs of Islam and follow the main practices, the rest of it gives you freedom to determine your own politics. Now, that is, in order to tackle the terrorist thing, the right approach is to recognize, yes, indeed, there are all these issues. And rather than trying to redefine Islam, and there you're playing straight into the battlefield where the terrorists say, no, Islam isn't like that. Islam has always said you have to wage jihad, defined in a particularly bloody form. Then you get completely caught in this traffic. That's one problem. Mm. The second problem is that you're inviting Muslims, whom you, in this context, into just act as a member of a Muslim community. I was there in London on July 7th. last year when
the bus
there was
bombing.
Bus bombing and underground bombing. In fact, I had gone through Piccadilly line not long before. I was appalled to hear the appeal coming from the government, including from the Prime Minister, and have the greatest of respect for Tony Blair for his magnanimity, generosity, and humanity. But I think also intellectually, I felt very let down that it was again and again appealed to the Muslim community to get its act together. Now, a British Muslim, why does he have to act only through his Islamic community? He's a member of the society. He can act through his political party, Labour, Conservative, Liberal. He can act through his local council. He can act through his profession as a doctor, as a scientist.
So let's loosen up the potential straitjacket of identity. You're saying, Amartya Sen, we have a lot of listeners who want to interact with you.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm going on and on.
No, it's great to hear it, and we're glad to. We're with Amartya Sen, Nobel Prize winner. His new book is Identity and Violence, The Illusion of Destiny, at 800-423-TALK. Chris is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I listen to your show every day.
Hi.
I'd like to mention also the illusion of control that religion brings about to people, that it almost sounds like a sickness that over time, slowly, if you look at Christianity, for example, over time it had its dark ages, and you almost look at the Muslim world as a new dark age because it's divide and conquer, more or less, and I'll just have my comments taken off the air.
So, Chris, are you then blaming this tight, strict identity box that Amartya Sen's describing on religion?
Yes. Like, for me personally, I look at it as, like, it's your own personal belief. It's a private thing. And the example of, you know, churches or mosques is almost pressuring people into, well, if you're not with us, then, you know, you don't belong here. It's like a divide and conquer, even not with saying anything, but just with the buildings itself, you know, more or less.
Right, inside the walls or outside the walls. Chris, thanks for your call. Amartya Sen, speak to the issue of religion, if you would, because on the one hand, it's easy to see people rallying around religion. You're naming religions today in your description of these tight identities. On the other hand, religions are often the source of the message that says, look beyond division. We are all God's children. That kind of message, I mean, you're speaking to a very high concept of humanity spanning these identities. So is religion the problem, or is it the way out, or how do you look at it?
Well, I think Chris is right to think that there is a concern here. But you are also right to point out that religion has so many different aspects. But I think the real clue to the answer to the question is something which Chris himself offered when he said that religion is a personal matter of your beliefs and so on, which I think is right. Now, of course, it could also be a source of organization and sometimes major organization, whether you think about missionary activities or relief, from famine. I've worked with Christian organizations in the 3 years when I was president of Oxfam. Even though I don't have great religious beliefs myself, it was very good for me to be able to interact with Christian communities and other religious communities. And the same world broad outlook that you referred to, Tom, you see in Islam too. And, you know, historically, it has varied a lot. That is, some Muslims, some Christians, some Hindus have taken very belligerent view, others have taken an extraordinarily tolerant view. And it's a question of recognizing that it's not religion itself that's doing it, but it can be used for the purpose of instigating violence. And, then you define religion in terms of community, not just the inclusion of others in the same group, but exclusion of others who are not in the group. So I think it's that abuse of religion that we have to deal with. And in dealing with it, we have to recognize that religious identity is only one of our many different identities. And the world exists in all kinds of dimensions. There's another interesting point Chris made about Islam and compared with Christianity. I think I should mention it, that it indeed may look like that in terms of today's conflict. On the other hand, you can think of a period when exactly the opposite could be said, when in the end of 16th century, Muslim King Akbar was the emperor of India, a largely, a country of Hindus and Muslims with a Hindu majority. He was very aware of the fact that he was ruling over a multicultural country. He codified rights of different groups of people, including minorities, as well as majorities belonging to different communities, have regular discussion between them, between Christians too, Muslims, Hindus, Christians, Jains, Parsis, Jews, even atheists.
So don't assume that Islam means
identity
boxing.
But just, if I may just say one thing, that is exactly the time when Giordano Bruno was burnt at the stake in Rome for apostasy, at a time when the one of the most powerful Muslim leaders in the world was extraordinarily tolerant, and when Christian church is not tolerant. So things have varied over the time. There is a long history of tolerance and political moderation in among Islamic rulers. After all, Maimonides found a refuge in the court of Emperor Saladin in Egypt.
Of course, he fled a pretty tough
intolerant.
But he fled a pretty tough Islamic scene in Spain.
12th century in Spain
and Morocco,
as well as Christian. Well, indeed, but the Spain, of course, was battleground of Christianity and Islam at that time.
But your point is that you can find veins of tolerance, openness, and close-mindedness in all religions. We can't tie one tight box around a religion, say that's it, we're the other, and we're going to fight with them, period.
Yeah, and you can't treat it as just a basic characteristic of a religion. And that's why I think a term like moderate Muslim is such a confusion, because you're really trying to capture moderateness in politics. But a person could be an extreme believer in religion, as far as religion goes, and yet be extremely liberal in politics. I think that's what a moderate Muslim illustrates my point in trying to miniaturize human beings into one identity. When you want to say moderate in politics, but no matter whether deeply religious or not religious, then you suddenly have one, since you have only one category to fit in, you produce this, these monstrosities of concept, like a moderate Muslim, as if, you know, the moderation of politics is the same thing as not being strongly religious. But, I mean, people could be very religious. I mean, Gandhi was extremely religious, but extremely moderate in politics. So I think it's a confusion that stems from the thing that, Tom, you and I began discussing at the beginning of this.
Jerry's calling from Ashaway, Rhode Island. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've spent the last year talking to people on both sides of the supposed moral divide in this country, and we found lots of self-hatred because of people's mixed-up multiple identities. People who describe themselves as evangelical Christians who are big fans of Desperate Housewives, you know, sort of a cultural icon, and secular liberals who look for moral order in society and want to teach their kids values, but can't really teach tolerance because it's too squishy a concept.
So what do you take from that complexity you found, Jerry?
Well, that at the end of the day, with all of our sort of mixed up complexities, we actually do have more in common when we're able to sort of put our identities in the blender. You know, we've asked people lots of questions about their identity, but then about the things they have in common, and we've just found lots and lots more commonality among folks when they're able to sort of be confronted by their by the sort of inconsistencies in their identity.
And that would seem to confirm Amartya Sen's thesis here, but then why around the world do we see people, you know, going to the ramparts to fight along identity lines, Jerry?
I think it's the whole idea that the professor said that they've been sold a bill of goods. I mean, we've talked to lots of Christians who feel like there's been a war on them, and we remind them that they're winning in the public square left and right. And they look at us kind of befuddled, but their leaders tell them they're under attack all the time.
Jerry, thanks for your call. Amartya Sen, Jerry brings this up, and you did too. You described the instigators of this pushing of narrow identity. Jerry says people have been sold a bill of goods, but who's doing the instigating? Who's selling the bill of goods? Aren't we all kind of in this together?
Well, we are. I think there are two things here. One is, I mean, you're right to ask the question, Tom, that who is doing the instigating? Well, of course, those who want the violence are. Consciously, like the terrorists and the people recruiting for terrorists, but then unconsciously, those who try to retaliate in a confused way by accepting that single identity and overlooking the richness of the world to which Jerry was pointing, then try to work everything together, not in the civil society, not in hundreds of other ways through which, you know, people, as Jerry said, we have many, many common things across each boundary. Instead of that, they then concentrate only that one hardened line of impenetrable division to make it more penetrable. But I think that's really, you know, a kind of mug's job, really. So I think some of the instigation is conscious. Some of it results from confusion. I mean, I'm really looking at the intellectual roots of violence, and therefore I have to be critical not just of those who are generating this in a conscious way, but also those, because of being flustered opponents, getting themselves caught in a kind of wrong understanding of the nature of the world. I think the other point that Jerry was making is that even without instigation, people get confused by the fact that if you are thinking about just one line, trying to put their all their loyalty in, you know, being, I think, evangelical or one thing or the other, just that, and then all the other things somehow had to be accommodated. And that generates a source of tension, which Jerry, I think, very, very richly pointed out. And I think that is also extraordinarily important. So I think we have to look at instigation, at how instigations may occur without being intended through confusion, as well as the propensity to confusion that exists when we do not assert most strongly that living a life is to recognize that we all have many, many different affiliations, associations, and that's something which is common between us.
But it's not just abroad that these hard lines of identity are being drawn. It was just, what, a couple of 3 years ago, we had General Jerry Boykin, U.S. Army general, lecturing around the country, you know, saying, my God is bigger than their God. The sort of Christian God is bigger than the Muslim God. I mean, that's hardly in a cave in Afghanistan.
Well, yes, but, you know, I think the point to make here, General Boykin, if he is a general, I've forgotten what his rank was. I mean, his inane statements about the Christian God being larger than the Muslim God and the Muslim God being an idol, of course, you know, altogether a level of idiocy which is hard to imagine. But I think ultimately it is so inane that it does far less harm than the more confused, more well-meaning statement, which doesn't go that route at all. And it then, what it does try to do is to put politics into each of the religions, saying Islam is a religion of peace. Now, of course, there have been great leaders of peace in the world who are Muslim, but that's because their politics is peaceful. There have also been equally faithful Muslims who have not pursued that line, gone in a different direction.
And on the other side,
so the harm that's done, take India. We have had, I just now mentioned, Akbar as a great Muslim leader who did more. I think the Indian secular constitution today derives more from that Muslim leader's extraordinarily powerful ideas of 1590s. At the same time, there was also very powerful and very nasty invaders like Sultan Mahmud of Ghazni, who ruined everything, broke temples, and did all kinds of nasty things.
If I may, I want to bring this, keep it a little more up to date. I mean, it's 2003 we're talking about.
I agree with that.
Now, General Boykin. General Boykin is now Deputy Undersecretary for Intelligence.
Pentagon.
It's not just abroad that these lines are drawn.
But Tom, if I'm giving the impression that I'm not appalled by General Boykin, that's not what I want to give. I think General Boykin is utterly appalling, and yet what I'm saying is that in some ways a right-thinking American citizen I don't think it's greatly deceived by Boykin's peculiar views. On the other hand, views which are not so nasty and not so stupid have much greater potential of getting a loyalty, and therefore in what I'm saying is that one has to be more concerned about the kind of violence that's generated by confusion of a ultimately well-meaning kind, but which had counterproductive result, as opposed to just the inane stupidity of the kind that Boykin represents. Of course, Boykin, you know, that statement is an absolutely ridiculous, nasty statement to which one should protest. But there is another kind of danger, which is much much harder to deal with, because it looks superficially plausible, and yet it ultimately miniaturizes human beings in terms of just one categorization.
Let's take a call from Christine in Newton. Hi, Christine. You're on the air.
Hi. I totally agree with the analysis that we have this multifaceted identity. What my concern is in the current climate in the world, that there's a perception that countries believe one thing or another. We have President Bush who's pursuing a policy in the Middle East that a lot of Americans don't agree with. But I don't know if that multifaceted perspective is necessarily conveyed, because we have narrow forms of communication that with other countries. It's mostly through our political leaders, through our media. I mean, maybe perhaps there's some other communication through the internet, but that's kind of disorganized. So what do we do as being an American and seeing your country represented a certain way and seeing a negative reaction to America? How do you confront that singular identity that's being promoted out there when it also appears that others across the world don't necessarily understand the democratic model? If you look, for example, at the recent incident of the cartoons being published in Denmark, it seemed like they were calling on the Danish leaders to get the cartoons retracted. Yet in their system, like in our system, a political leader would never have that power to get those cartoons retracted.
Christine, let us pick it up. Amartya Sen, does globalization help or hurt? And how do you communicate? Even in this tightly bound world, we've got all kinds of communications. Yeah. And Christine says, in spite of that, we get sort of stick figure images passed back and forth.
You know, I agree. I think Christine is absolutely right. And there are different issues. Of course, on the cartoon issue, there is a question of right to publication, which, of course, we would defend very strongly as being a very important right, any country in the world, including in Denmark. And yet there's also the other issue, which could also be raised. We don't have time to discuss that so much, whether, you know, you may have a right to publish something, whether you have a reason to publish it is a different question. And I think what one has to be seen is whether it would have appeared to Muslims as in a sense, reducing them by portraying the prophet in a particular way. I mean, obviously, the bomb as a hat is a figment of imagination. The question is whether it is disrespectful to Muslims, and if so, how do we deal with a conflict on one side, people having the right to publication, which they press for, and on the other side, there is a question of also being sensible in using that right. Now, that's a very rich thing, but I think I want to come back to Christine's main point with which he started, namely the countries are often portrayed as having just one of those identities. I think that's been, you know, I am from India and still remain an Indian citizen or resident here. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean in San Francisco from where I'm speaking. I came only yesterday from the East Coast for a lecture here, but in Massachusetts. With the diversity that we have in countries, it is possible to have representation of that. I mean, in India, it's a country of 82% Hindus. If you now look at the leadership of the country, the president is a Muslim, Abdul Kalam. The prime minister is a Sikh, Manmohan Singh. The leader of the ruling party, Congress, is Sonia Gandhi, who's Christian. Mm. Not one Hindu among these three. And I think the country is still not exploding, not regarded as very peculiar.
And yet there's a powerful Hindu nationalist movement there and has been for years now.
Well, that was defeated in the last election. Mm-hmm. And what I'm referring to is what emanated from that. That, again, Manmohan Singh was not the prime minister earlier.
Yep.
So what I'm saying is that even the violence which took place in Gujarat, and in particularly at Muslims, that actually had a tremendous electoral consequence. So I think ultimately, I think Christine's question is right. The answer to that is that democracy is not just about voting. It's about also the protection of minority view and minority rights, and in which majority can play a part. And I'm proud of the fact that ultimately the Indian population, with more than 80% Hindus, did reject the previous approach to a Hindu nationalist government and had a much broader secular government now in office back again. The previous one claimed to be secular also, I have to say. But I think it's really democracy, and no country has done as much as America in teaching the world about how to deal with fundamental rights and how to combine a majoritarian politics with the protection of rights. So I think if we know the problem, we also know the solution. And democracy, of course, is part of the solution that we have to look for.
Amartya Sen, I wish you'd take us back to a traumatizing moment in your life. You were 11 years old at the time of the partition of India and Pakistan approaching. You saw a vivid example of this right in front of you at age 11 that I think tells us a lot about what informs your view today, the story of Khadr Mia.
Yes, indeed. It was a traumatic experience. I was 11, as you say, in the city of Dhaka, which is now the capital of Bangladesh. We lived in areas which was primarily Hindu area. And there was but the Hindu-Muslim riots were very new there at that time. It had just erupted. It hadn't happened for living memory. And suddenly there was this killing going on. And one morning as a child when I was in the garden, I saw a person profusely bleeding coming in. He was a Muslim laborer. He had come for a little bit of work. He had to come because he had no income, nothing at home to eat. So he was compelled by economic necessity to seek a job against some risk. Mm. And then he got killed. And I was just amazed that he could be killed by people who didn't even know him. All they knew him was that his religion was different from that of the people killing him. And I think it was a kind of a very early lesson for me as to what a unified, fostered, solitarist identity can do to human beings. Suddenly everything else, all the richness to which the earlier speakers, Christine, Jerry and Chris, referred to, being drowned in just that one singular identity. I'm a Hindu or I'm a Muslim. Mm. I'm opposed to the other community.
And let me ask you, our time is so short. You know, we understand that, and yet borders are real, cultures are real. I mean, just today we're getting word of a big breakthrough on Capitol Hill in Washington on the immigration bill there. And yet people look at the border, they look at their identities around that border. Identity is a big word this week in the United States. You're in California,
speak. But identity should always be a big word. I'm not against identity. I'm in favor of giving identity its due. You know, we identify with so many things. And depending on the context, some identity could be very important. And in other contexts, not. And my vegetarian identity may be extraordinarily important if I go to dinner, but not if I go to an economics lecture. Mm. It depends on what the context is. So I think identities are fine. Even citizenship and the fact that, you know, each country might have some way of determining how many new citizens from elsewhere they want. I mean, this is a different kind of issue. From the issue that we have to be somehow, as a result, hostile to people who are on the other side of the line according to one classification, even though in terms of another classification, they may be on exactly the same side. So I think Jerry, one of your questionnaires put that we have this richness of so many different identities, and to get them all drowned in just this, you know, the either-or view of one divisive identity. That's ultimately what I have. We began with discussing the clash of civilization. That's what the difficulty I have. I absolutely don't take the view that Sam Huntington, whom I greatly respect in many ways, is actually trying to advocate. But he is caught because he's worried in having pictured a view which is divided around just one identity. And if I saw the world that way, I would be worried too. But I don't think that's the way to see the world. I think there is a vision that we have got from our past and from our present, which recognizes that the richness of human life, all the different identities we have.
Amartya Sen, Nobel Prize winner in economics, writing much more broadly now, author of the new book, Identity and Violence, The Illusion of Destiny. We're very grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Matt Odette and Angel Coselli, our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.